I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. We've all heard stories of medical miracles, cases where patients defy the odds and survive or recover from trauma or illness. Typically, those are feel-good stories on the evening newscast or in magazines, and we rarely hear the story from the perspective of the physician involved in the case. Dr. Harley Rothbart has compiled stories of medical miracles in the words of the physicians who witnessed the event. The book is titled Miracles We Have Seen, America's Leading Physicians Share Stories They Can't Forget. And Dr. Rothbart joins us on the phone from Colorado. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mindy. It's good to be here.
And joining us in studio is Dr. Paul Scudder, a Cape physician who contributed two essays to the collection. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Rothbart, when and why did you come up with this idea to put together this collection of essays about medical miracles?
The history actually goes back more than 30 years to a miracle that occurred on my watch. I was a resident at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, and we were called about two young boys, brothers, who had been brought into the emergency room, a three-year-old and a seven-year-old, and they were on their way up to the intensive care unit where I was on call. The three-year-old had fallen in to a partially drained swimming pool, submerged. It was the middle of winter. The seven-year-old dived in to rescue his three-year-old brother, pushed the little boy to the stairs so the boy's head was above water, but ultimately both of them succumbed to the cold. By the time fire rescue got there, they were both blue and not breathing, obviously unconscious. They were rushed to the emergency room and then to the ICU. The three-year-old, the youngest brother, recovered pretty quickly, and within a matter of a couple of days, he was neurologically normal and able to go home. But our hero, the seven-year-old, didn't, and he lingered in a coma, a deep coma, for weeks in the ICU, and we had little hope for his recovery. And in fact, we had been discussing with the family brain death protocols and organ donation. I was reading to him one night, as we tried to do when we were on call, and holding his hand, no response for weeks from this little boy. And I felt him squeeze my hand. And I told my superiors about that the next morning on rounds, and they said, you know, it's an involuntary muscle spasm. But then someone else found it, and then by that afternoon, the next afternoon, he was squeezing hands on command. Everyone was elated. The family couldn't believe it, but we were all still worried. This little boy had potential for significant brain damage, but within a matter of a couple of weeks, to our crying and cheering, he walked out of Children's Hospital, and I was changed forever.
Mm. So did you reach out to physicians and say other physicians must have stories like this? How did you get other physicians involved in this project?
That's exactly right. I am blessed after 30-plus years in practice to have colleagues all over the country like Dr. Scudder, and I reached out to them and said, you know, this happened to me. Here's a little essay that I wrote about it. Have you had any experiences like that? And it broke down about a third, a third, a third. About a third of my colleagues said, you know, it's nice to hear from you, but nothing really comes to mind. And the other third, another third said, yeah, it's a good idea. Let me think about it, and I'll get back with you. And rarely did I hear back. But it's that other third, the third like Dr. Scudder, who said, oh, I've got a story, or in Paul's case, a couple of stories that I've been waiting to tell. Thanks for asking.
All right, so you get the ask, Dr. Scudder, and were you just saying, did you know immediately what stories you wanted to talk about?
Well, there were several that came to mind, and the two that I ended up writing about were stories that actually don't come out of my immediate clinical practice, and somehow that seemed to fit the mode of this. They were both stories that occurred in volunteer environments, and I just thought that was particularly telling. I don't know, somehow it spoke to me a little more than the stories that I see more commonly in my day-to-day practice. And interestingly, I happen to be a vascular surgeon. There are a couple of other vascular surgeon stories in the book which echo the kind of things I might have written about had I stayed within the day-to-day hospital practice that I commonly perform. I have to be honest, my first response when Harley asked me about this was, I can't do that. And he said, why not? You must have seen things like this. I said, that's not the problem, Harley. The problem is I haven't even tried any creative writing in 35 years. So with enough enough needling, he encouraged me to give it a shot, and I'm pleased how it worked out. And mostly I'm pleased to be part of this unique group of people involved in a charitable project.
Yeah. Tell us about the proceeds of this book. I mean, in the end of the book, you've got a gazillion different charities listed, but where's the money going?
Well, the carrot that I used to help solicit essays was that none of this would benefit me, pardon me, or any of the essayists. Everyone who submitted an essay, I asked for a preferred charity to donate the proceeds to. And among the, there were 85 essays in the book contributed by 75 esteemed physicians from around the country, and among them they named 65 charities. There was some overlap. 65 charities that will benefit by all the author proceeds that would have otherwise come from sales, royalties, etc. So it allows Paul and me to be shameless in our promoting this book, because the only thing in it for us is to feel really good about what the book is accomplishing.
Right. Now, in the introduction to the book, you write that despite being at the forefront of medicine and science, what we don't understand often exceeds what we do understand. So why did you choose the term miracle to describe the events recounted in the essays?
Well, I don't know how else. It would have taken me a full paragraph in the title to have somehow otherwise explained the breadth of stories that emerged from this project. There are stories that include, for example, a window washer in Manhattan whose platform gave way on the 47th story of a skyscraper, and he free falls 47 stories onto a cement alleyway. The chances of survival after falling three stories are about 50%. After falling 10 stories, almost 0%. This man fell 47 stories and is now doing charity walks and driving his kids to school and is neurologically normal. It ranges from that to stories like Paul's, where there are miracles that occur over time on the battlefield or in the unlikeliest place, where an ICU would have been handy, on the side of a mountain, where a man was resuscitated and brought back literally from death on the side of a mountain, and all the way to the story of a little five-year-old boy whose oncologist watched that little boy have some kind of a mesmerizing experience that the oncologist can only describe as the little boy who saw heaven that day as he took his last breath and died. Mm. Now, how to characterize the breadth of those stories other than to use the word miracle, which is the word that most of the essayists preferred, because they consider those to be miracles.
Yeah, some of these stories just absolutely blew me away, and we're going to get into that. But first, Dr. Scott, one of your stories was inspired by your father's service. Tell us about that story.
Well, my father was a immigrant from Britain as a toddler, and grew up in a family of very, very meager resources, didn't complete high school. And when the Second World War broke out, he felt that it would be a reasonable choice to join the military. Of course, he wasn't a citizen, so that resulted in a certain delay of being naturalized. Was finally drafted, and I could go through the story. It has some interesting twists to it. But in the end, he ends up serving as an enlisted man, as a private, in a TV audience would describe as a MASH hospital, working its way across Europe following D-Day. He walked up on Omaha Beach a few days afterwards carrying a box full of medical equipment and worked his way across Europe. His unit was just outside the battle lines in the Battle of the Bulge and treated soldiers actually from both sides who were so badly wounded in that situation. So we fast forward 30 or 40 years to the time of the Afghan-Iraq crisis, and the American military was obviously at war once again. And part of a war effort is the medical effort that supports it and treats the injured soldiers. And I happen to be, as I say, a vascular surgeon, and vascular surgeons are not the largest specialty in the country for civilian medicine, But there certainly is an acute need for vascular surgery following wartime injuries. Hemorrhage, damaged blood vessels are unfortunately all too common. So as it was, the Army wanted to send as many of their certified vascular surgeons as they could into the battlefield hospitals in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they worked with our National Society of Vascular Surgeons to recruit volunteers to provide services in the major Army hospital outside of the battle zones that took care of most of these injuries. And that happened to be in Germany, adjacent to the Ramstein Air Base. It's a very large, wonderfully well-equipped American hospital at the Landstuhl Medical Base in Germany. And I, seeing this, felt a very strong pull, being as my father's life had turned after his time serving in the Medical Corps in the Army in the 1940s. That inspired him to go back to high school after the war, eventually through college and medical school on the GI Bill, and to work as a surgeon on the faculty of an Ivy League hospital for most of his career. And I certainly owe my career to his experience in the Army Medical Corps, although he was not in medicine at that mm-hmm. time. So it was very natural for me when the call went out for volunteers to say, pick me, pick me. And off I went.
Yeah. And it is really amazing. The injuries are just horrific, and it's how far we've come to be able to help these military folks survive injuries they never would have survived in wars past.
Well, I tried to distill it down to a few paragraphs in the story, and make some reference to some of the major medical advances that have come out of each of the conflicts that unfortunately we've been involved in over the past few generations. And so many of the things that we do every day in our hospitals all around the United States evolved out of the medical care provided to battlefield injuries during the course of the several wars. In a sense, it's analogous to how much of the modern tech revolution evolved out of the space program. And what I mean by that is, you know, you go back as far as the Civil War, and all we could really do was amputate an injured part. In the First World War, we were able to give transfusions for the first time. In the Second World War, for the first time, we had antibiotics. As we moved to Korea for the first time, and this is a little bit near and dear to the vascular surgeon's heart, we were actually able to repair injured blood vessels. In the Vietnam War, some very critical intensive care understanding evolved, particularly with regard to the lung decompensation that occurs after major injuries and major surgery, and this is now a major part of ICU care throughout the country. And this has just continued to evolve in conflict after conflict. And one of the statistics that was most telling to me is that when soldiers in World War II were injured on the battlefield, the death rate was about 50%. About one out of two soldiers that was injured survived. When we got to the Afghanistan War, if a soldier was injured on the battlefield and made it to the first level of medical care, in other words, they weren't killed instantly, the survival rate was 98%. But it took a huge investment, and it was a very impressive organization to be part of.
Yeah. I have to talk about the one story that just blew. I mean, there were so many that blew me away, but the one that really blew me away was the 15-year-old girl who contracted rabies and became the first person to survive it. As I'm reading this, I'm like, oh, no, rabies, she's a goner.
Absolutely.
Oh, my. Absolutely. Then I was like, why didn't I hear? I actually went and Googled it after and went, oh, my gosh, there was news reports about this. But what an amazing story that was.
Yeah, it was, Mindy. This was written by a colleague, Rod Willoughby, in Wisconsin. And Rod was part of this remarkable story, as was Archbishop Michael Timothy Cardinal Dolan, who's currently the Archbishop of New York. This is a little girl, a 15-year-old. Her name is Jenna, and she's given consent to tell this story and to use her name. She was bitten in church by a bat that had swooped down. A man knocked the bat to the ground, and little Jenna was an animal lover, and she picked the bat up to release it outside, and on the way out, the bat bit her. And the family mom put on peroxide, thought nothing of it, and then a month later, she's got full-blown drooling rabies, and no one had ever survived that disease. People may recall that we do have a vaccine, so if you know you're exposed, you can be immunized and protected, but no one protected her, no one gave her the vaccine, no one thought much about a bat bite, and she was on her way to death, as every patient with full-blown rabies was. And they were going to try, due to really the parents' generosity, who said, you know, is there anything that we can do to benefit others? There was an experimental protocol that no one had ever tried in a human before. It had been tried in rats. No one had ever tried it in humans. And they got quick consent from the family and from the institution to try this. And the family said, if it can help someone else, let's try it. And while they were beginning to start the experimental therapy, an unknown priest, unknown to the family, walked in and asked the doctor if he could lay on the hands. He did, and then he left. And this little girl, by virtue of the experimental therapy, by virtue of prayer, we really don't know, but this little girl survived and is now a mom herself and completely normal neurologically. And the priest was named by the Pope to be the Archbishop of New York several years later. And he has actually been one of the endorsers of the book. He wrote on the back cover as a witness to one of the miracles recounted in this uplifting book, "I welcome Dr. Rothbart's extraordinary collection of compelling testimonies from leading physicians, Timothy Michael Cardinal Dolan, Archbishop of New York." Since that time, there have been numerous patients with full-blown rabies who have survived as a result of this treatment and the generosity, really, of the family in allowing an experiment on their daughter.
And we should say not everybody does survive with this treatment. So there have
That's
been
correct.
Yeah, but I mean, amazing that the ones who have survived that. We're talking with Dr. Harley Rothbart and Dr. Paul Scudder about the book Miracles We Have Seen. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Harley Rothbart and Dr. Paul Scudder about the book Miracles We Have Seen, America's Leading Physicians Share Stories They Can't Forget. So, Dr. Scudder, would you consider the experiences you recount in the book as miracles as well? I mean, I think a lot of times when people think of miracles, there's sort of this like kind of religious sort of feeling to it, some people might call it serendipity.
I don't think it really matters for the purposes of the book. Yeah. I think that I personally am willing to accept the reality of miracles. I think some of these stories certainly fit that. But I think there's a broader definition of miracles that's at play. And I think that that includes things like what we were just talking about with the battlefield injuries, mm-hmm. where it's a miracle of human endeavor that we've been able to make all this much progress. The story I told about what, as Harley put it, a ICU on the side of a mountain, in a sense, is a miracle as well. It's a miracle that all the right people were there and just enough equipment was there to result in the survival of somebody who, you know, really wouldn't have had much a chance in most settings in that environment. So I think regardless of whether we accept the divinity or the religious side of miracles, the word has a broader definition of wonderful things that have happened that perhaps couldn't have been predicted. And I think that really fits a lot of these. And that's particularly true when you look through the book as a whole. And, you know, in some of the stories, the protagonist, for lack of a better term, actually does not survive. But the miracle that the essayist refers to has to do with the impact that these events have had on the people around them. Mm. And the like. So I think it takes just a little bit broader view of the word miracles to really process it. I think, Harley, you more or less agree with that viewpoint.
I do, absolutely, Paul. And the if one looks strictly at the concrete religious facets of the book, there are mentions in many of the stories about prayer. There are mentions in many of the stories about faith. But really, the reason that it was so important for me to have the physicians write these essays is because I wanted them to be as authentic a telling of the events as possible so that there would be no doubt in the minds of the readers that these were true events as opposed to perhaps inspirations and more subjective perceptions of what happened as read in the newspaper or as told even by a patient. These are scientists. These are evidence-based physicians who are writing these stories, and many of them use the term miracle in and of themselves and chose to interpret what happened. And these are physicians of all religious backgrounds, many of them undeclared. And in fact, one of my favorite stories to tell is that of the atheist physician
right. Who
is caring for the atheist patient. And this man is dying of a mesothelioma, a horrific asbestos-related tumor that has literally burst through from his lungs through the chest wall and is now apparent on the outside on this man's breast, a tumor that is going to be incurable. And this atheist patient, cared for by the atheist doctor, the patient goes on vacation because this is his last chance, and he and his wife visit a monastery, and they go into the monastery and walk out, and he feels some renewed strength, and within a matter of weeks, the tumor disappears. Now, the atheist doctor writes about his atheist patient, if this was not a miracle, I don't know what is. Mm-hmm. And so, really, religion is up to the interpretation of the reader, and that's intentional. But the word miracle, as Paul described it, is much bigger than simply a religious experience.
Yeah. I love the chapter, Spectacular Serendipity, and that speaks so well to the story of the doctor who goes to Haiti with his son. Tell that story. Talk about the sequence of events that lead through the story is amazing.
Well, this is the story is about three teenagers, and Haiti in the devastation that followed the horrific natural disasters there. Haiti was the site of many volunteer groups. This volunteer group went to a particularly impoverished village where there was rarely electricity, and when there was, it was spotty. And they desperately needed, there was no equipment, they desperately needed an EKG machine, An American hospital donated an EKG machine, and the first group of volunteers went down to Haiti. A teenager was among that group, and the EKG machine didn't work. And they got down there, and they were so upset because they finally had a machine, and it didn't work. So it turns out this teenager is part of a computer techie group back at school, and he said, you know, I bet you my club at school can fix this thing. And so the EKG machine gets shipped back to the States, and sure enough, teen number one fixes the machine with his colleagues, and the machine, EKG machine, now makes a second trip down to Haiti. So the second trip down to Haiti, there's also a teen on this trip, but he wasn't supposed to be there because he's a basketball star, and the way that he got, this teenager high school basketball star, the way that he got to Haiti is his dad was one of the volunteers, but his dad wasn't supposed to be there. The reason his dad was there is because dad went to the wrong gym to watch his son play basketball. His son was playing in a different gym, but at the wrong gym, he ran into a volunteer, a physician, who wrote the essay for this book. This is Dr. Ring and Mary Catherine Ring wrote this essay. And at the wrong gym, this doctor said, I'm at the wrong gym. What's up with you guys? And they said, well, we're on our way to Haiti. Have you ever thought about making a trip like that? And he said, no, I haven't, but I would love to. I would love to bring my son. Is that okay? And they said, that would be great. So this doctor who showed up at the wrong gym to watch his basketball star play basketball goes down with his son to Haiti. And the EKG machine is now working, and they need a volunteer to be the first person to have the EKG machine tested on. And so the teenager is the volunteer, and they strap him up to the EKG machine, and they find, to their horror, that this healthy, strapping basketball player has a congenital heart disease that is potentially lethal. It's the kind of disease, you know, that we read about of a star athlete collapses and dies unresuscitatable on the playing field or on the basketball court. So this young teenager, a privileged young man, son of a doctor in Boston, is taken back to the United States. And while there, he has the corrective surgery that saves his life. And the surgeon, the heart surgeon, says, is there anything more that we can do for you? And he says, Doc, you know, there is. We met a teenager, an orphan in Haiti, who has horrible congenital, horrible rheumatic heart disease. It's an acquired disease from an infection. And she has no way to be helped. There is no surgeon there. No one can help her. And so to make an already long story shorter, they went all the way through a congressperson who had just been elected in Boston to pave the way to get the paperwork done for this teenage, young teenage girl, the third teen, to come to America to get restorative heart surgery. And because of the serendipity of three teenagers, one who fixed an EKG machine, another who had potentially fatal heart disease, himself saved by the EKG machine, and a third who was the beneficiary of the second teen's insistence that he should not be the only one cured of his heart disease because he happens to be the son of a doctor in America. This third teen, an orphan, is now alive and well in Haiti because of this miraculous EKG machine.
Wow. So it pays to show up at the wrong gym, huh?
Right. It pays to show up at the wrong gym. That's exactly right.
Now, we should say these essays are written by physicians or and folks in the medical field, but do they? They're not technical. I mean, they're purposely written so that we can all understand.
That's right. That was my biggest job. Yeah. My biggest job was to make sure that all of the essays are written in lay terms and in the simplest possible way to convey the miracle without being bogged down in the medical jargon.
And in these, a lot of these stories, we hear the physicians say how whatever miracle they witnessed, how much it changed their lives or impacted their lives. And I guess that's a question for both of you, as you experience whatever miracles you have seen in your career. How is that? It changed how you practice medicine? Has it? I mean, what has it done being a witness to something like this?
Well, it emphasizes the real reasons why we're in medicine, which is the human side of it. It emphasizes the fact that, you know, it isn't about the business of medicine, but it's about the way we can touch people's lives by changing their lives. And you change the lives not just of the protagonist individual, the patient themselves, but everybody around them. Mm-hmm. You change the lives, you know, in the one story of the person who had a heart attack on the side of a mountain. Not only does he live, but his family still has a father and a spouse and whatnot for years to come. And you change the lives of a lot of people, a lot of soldiers who were helped in Germany. And, of course, this goes on in our hospitals from day to day as well. Again, this isn't totally confined to those one or two things that we see. And it's these stories that help us through the times when we see patients that we really can't help. Mm-hmm. It's also these stories that help us to try to be as compassionate as possible with every single individual who comes along because they remind us of both the fragility but the wonder of the human condition.
Yeah. What about you, Dr. Burpart?
I think that the, and I agree with everything Paul said, of course, there's also a humility and a humanity that these experiences convey to the physician. So from that experience 30 years ago that I described of the two little boys who drowned, to this day, I have never been able to walk out of a patient's room, no matter how dire the circumstances, without leaving a glimmer of hope for that patient. And without saying, you know, I just don't know everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm actually relieved that I don't, because I want to be surprised. And in the case of a horrible prognosis, that's just the time that I do want to be surprised. And, of course, oftentimes we're not. Oftentimes our prognosis is unfortunately correct, and bad things do happen. But when good things happen unexpectedly, they reinvigorate us to think that it's good to not know everything. It's good to be wrong. And it's important to be humble about how much we do know and how little we know.
Mm-hmm. Another thought that comes to mind is how humbling the human spirit can be of these individuals. I won't tell another story, but another story is coming to mind of a patient I treated in the hospital. It was just a remarkable story that I've never forgotten and reminds me again of the strength of the human spirit and that kind of thing. And it's humbling to work around that.
There's a story in here from Dr. Adrian Weiss-Harrison, and I'm going to just read the beginning because I thought this was really interesting, something I think as patients we don't think about. She writes, "One aspect of doctoring that is rarely discussed and about which as little is written is the worry factor for physicians caring for a sick patient." You know, we know the families worry and the patients worry, but it's something, doctors are kind of always so calm, but you guys worry too.
Absolutely. I can't tell you how many nights were consumed by the events of that day and the concern for patients, the concern for families. And I mean, we would not be human and we could not be humane if we didn't bring that work home with us. We're taught not to, we're taught to toughen our skin and you got to leave it. It just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And if it does work, then I don't think the physician's having the kind of experience that they should be having. I think we bring it home with us and it's the burden that we carry.
Mindy, it's interesting that you brought that up because it's funny. I had a very challenging patient in the hospital last week who needed some major surgery in a pretty risky situation. And for whatever reason, the lady's husband asked me a question that led directly to that on the morning before the surgery and whatnot. And he's someone that I've known for a little while through his wife, but I felt comfortable just sort of sharing with him that I've really been worried about it. I've really been concerned about whether we're going to get your wife through all of this. Fortunately, it is working out well, but I kind of expressed to him how concerned I had been and how, again, without violating privacy but whatnot, I had talked to my family that I had such a challenging case and it was weighing on me for several days beforehand and whatnot. That's a very very poignant reference that you made to Dr. Weiss-Harrison's note there. And I think there's a lot of that, and it's a lot of it amongst physicians throughout the country. We're not unique in this.
Dr. Robert, what did you hear from physicians about the process of writing about their experiences?
I think that's one of the best outcomes, and there are so many wonderful outcomes of this book. The charity one that we mentioned, of course, at the top of the list, but I think physicians who did have stories to tell felt so glad to be able to tell them, in an official way that would actually be read by others. And there were some really wondrous things that happened. For example, some of the physicians, perhaps because we needed, for some of the stories, we needed patient consent, but also just because some of the physicians were curious after 25 years what happened to these patients. A number of the physicians reconnected with their patients as a result of these essays. I was one of them, actually. I cared for the first child diagnosed with AIDS in Colorado, and the miracle of his story is remarkable. I mean, it's miraculous. This is a little boy who was born before many years before there was any treatment. And he survived his AIDS and is now a dad himself and running a restaurant in Utah. And I reached out to him and said, "Jonathan, I want to tell your story. How are you?" And when I heard his voice on the phone, I cried because I had not seen him since he was a two-year-old child. And being able to contact him and tell his story for me as an essayist, besides editing everyone else's marvelous stories, as an essayist, being able to tell Jonathan's story and speak to him 30 years after he unimaginably survived AIDS when everyone else of that era without therapy died. Mm. He survived. Yeah. And I think for physicians to be able to relive these stories, to write these stories, and in some cases to reconnect with their patients was just magical.
Yeah, that was a great story, by the way. We're talking with Dr. Harley Rothbart and Dr. Paul Scudder about the book Miracles We Have Seen. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Dr. Harley Rothbart and Dr. Paul Scudder. The book Miracles We Have Seen, America's Leading Physicians Share Stories They Cannot Forget. So what was the process for editing or fact-checking the essays?
Well, I did not fact-check. These are vascular surgeons and deans and department heads and professors across the country. I trusted their retelling of the story, so I did not fact-check, but I did edit. And my primary goal was to make the essays readable to everyone. And my secondary goal was to make sure that they fit the mode the mode of the book, and in almost every case they did. A number of our essayists, and Paul was exceptional. I have to tell you that Paul said he hadn't done creative writing in years, but Paul's essays required almost no editing. They were so beautifully written. He dug deep, and he found that. He found that creative streak from years ago, but it's not true for everyone, and a lot of people. We have been in medicine. We are taught to write scientifically. We're taught to write in terms that colleagues can read, and many of the essays were a little stiff to begin with, and were a little too professional, and so I tried to humanize them, and the process really involved multiple back and forths, in some cases 12, 15 drafts exchanged from an essayist to me and back. In some cases, the essayist just asked if they could tell the story to me by phone as I rapidly scribbled notes, and then I constructed a ghost-written essay, and we worked back and forth to make sure that they were comfortable with all of my interpretation of their story.
You didn't tell me. I could have saved a lot of work by doing that, Harley.
I was going to ask you that, Dr. Scudder, because telling the story is very different than writing it. So what was that process like for you? I mean, did it just kind of come out, or did you have to go back and do a lot of revisions?
Well, the first thing I had to do is, well, I guess like a lot of the physicians in this, I've had some experience with technical writing and scientific writing for some journals and things of that nature, but I really hadn't attempted to write anything in more of a creative way that would flow as a story in quite a long time. It happened that the two stories I had lent themselves to that, and I wrote one of them first. I wrote the one about the patient with the heart attack first, and it did kind of flow pretty easily, and of course I went back over it quite a bit and, chopped out a bunch of unnecessary words and that kind of business whatnot. And it was after reading that, Harley, didn't you ask me if I'd write another one or something? I said, you got to be kidding me. The other one also flowed fairly well as well. So I think I was fortunate, but I really was intimidated by the prospect at first.
Yeah, I can imagine. Another story I wanted to talk about, this was a great story, The Unlikely Discovery by the Unlikeliest Person.
Yeah. This was a vascular surgery story told by Gib Upchurch, a vascular surgeon at University of Virginia, and by two others, because the story is told in three parts. This is there is a process in teaching medical students that uses what are called standardized patients. And these are volunteers from the community who are trained to mimic the story of a clinical disease, so medical students can interview them and examine them as pretend patients, as if they had the disease. It's part of the medical student educational process. Most medical schools do this. They use community volunteers, standardized patients, to come in and pretend to have something. And this man in Virginia was pretending on that day. He had pretended other diseases in the past, but he had been trained to pretend to have an abdominal aortic aneurysm, and he was prepped in the symptoms that he was supposed to complain about. And he was subject to the history taking and physical examination of 32 medical students over the course of several days. And the 32nd medical student to examine this man went through the history, heard the symptoms, did a physical exam, and felt what he thought was an abdominal aortic aneurysm, which is a ballooning of the major blood vessel that runs from our heart to provide blood for the rest of the body. And when there's a weakening in the wall, and Paul could describe this much better than I, but when there's a weakening,
Harley, you're doing great.
When there's a weakening in the wall of the aorta, blood can dissect into the weakening and balloon out the blood vessel, and if it bursts, it is a lethal condition. And the symptoms were told as this man was supposed to tell, but of course he had no knowledge that he had anything. He just told the symptoms he was taught to tell. But when the medical student felt the abdomen and felt a pulsating mass and then put a stethoscope on and heard a brewey, which is an abnormal sound that flows through an abnormal blood vessel, he went to his proctor, and all he wanted to do was pass the test. This was a clinical examination to get through this phase of his medical training. But he said, you know, I feel an aneurysm, and I think I hear one. And the proctor said, right. This is the 32nd medical student over a course of 2 or 3 days to examine this man who's pretending to have an aneurysm, and this medical student, this upstart medical student, says he feels something. So and the proctor said, yeah, right. And the medical student said, no, really, I do think so. Would you go in and check? And then the medical student rotates on to the next patient who's pretending to have something else. The proctor goes in and says, apologetically to the patient, you know, the medical student wanted me to take a poke at your belly. Would it be okay if I felt and listened also? And sure enough, the proctor, who was not a cardiologist and not a vascular surgeon, but a physician, heard and felt the same thing. And this man was referred to Dr. Upchurch, who's the third essayist in this story. the medical student, the proctor, and the vascular surgeon who ultimately repaired the aneurysm that this man had, all contributed their perspectives from their vantage points to this story. And the man's abdominal aortic aneurysm was repaired, and he attributes his life to this medical student, the 32nd one to feel his belly and the only one to feel anything abnormal. He attributes his life being saved to this medical student.
He got an A, I hope, right?
I hope he got an A. That's right.
That's such an incredible story. The book has been endorsed by the presidents or past presidents of nearly every major medical organization. So what does that say about the universality of these types of experiences?
Well, first of all, the specialists represented in the book represent virtually every field of medicine. Every specialty of medicine is represented from vascular surgeons like Dr. Scudder to psychiatrists, to internists, pediatricians, OBGYN doctors. And the heads of those major organizations recognize not only that their field is represented in the book, but that they are part of something very special in what they do, and that these stories reflect well on all physicians and reflect well on the practice of medicine in general. And so all the heads of all the major medical organizations really coalesced in endorsing this book.
Yeah. So what would you advise people who have serious or life-threatening illnesses or injuries or their families that are hoping for that miracle? Because that's everybody's hope, is that they're going to have the kind of miracle that we're reading about in this book. And I think you sort of touched on it earlier where you say you don't close that door to having a little bit of hope.
Well, that's the first thing. Absolutely right. And the other, I think the other two important points are that we have to accept good treatment when good treatment is available. We can't just hope for a miracle. My grandfather used to tell the story of the pious man who did only good deeds but it was impoverished, and he used to pray every day, "Dear Lord, help me win the lottery, help me win the lottery." And every day his poverty worsened, and he continued doing good deeds and giving what little he had away to others who were even less fortunate than him. And then one day he cries out and says, "Lord, what more can I do? I'm doing everything I can, and I prayed every day to win the lottery so I can eat for myself and my family and help others." And the booming voice comes down from heaven and says, "You've got to buy a ticket." and the moral of the story is, if there is therapy available, don't wait for a miracle. Mm-hmm. Take the therapy. You know, buy the ticket, and then you hope for the best. And I think that's important to advise patients that, gratefully, hopefully, miracles do occasionally happen. And when they do, we are all the better for it. We are all in wonder and awe as a result of it. But medicine, as I think Dr. Scudder's essays really illustrate, medicine has come a long way, and we can now make miracles that we couldn't have made during World War II or even 10 years ago or 5 years ago. And so there are miracles in the hands of physicians, and I think patients need to appreciate that they need to buy the ticket.
I think that patients, depending on their background, struggle with the uncertainty that we deal with in medicine. And I'll draw up two examples of that, although it's both examples involve stereotyping, which is an unfair process by its nature. But nonetheless, I think it's useful from an example situation. And one of the examples is people in the financial world. When I care for people with a background in the financial world, they're used to dealing with uncertainty, and they can communicate about the uncertainty of the outcome of an illness or sometimes a medical procedure in a way that's very familiar to a physician, and that flows easily. There are others, and one example might be engineers, who deal in a world which is much more absolute, and they struggle a lot more with the uncertainty around medicine. And that's an indirect answer to your question about what do you do if you hope for a miracle, but it's accepting the uncertainty that points out that sometimes these things do happen, and there is a flip side to that, which is that sometimes they don't. Another comment that comes to mind speaks a little bit to what Harley said about the you need to buy a ticket, and that is that I think a lot of us, at least in areas of medicine where we perform procedures, run into a lot of distrust and a lot of, I sometimes say, the don't wants. I don't want this treatment or I don't want that treatment. And as Harley says, it's hard for things to work out for the best if we don't use what's available to us, if we don't use the tools in the toolbox. And I'm not saying that that's true in every single case. But nonetheless, have an open mind to what's being offered to you and what the opportunities are for you there.
And I think also, too, it's interesting, how grateful, obviously, a lot of these patients were for their miracle. And I can't remember the story, but I remember it was the gentleman who had the miracle. He lived another 11 years, and he called it his bonus years. Do you remember that story?
Yes.
Sure,
yeah.
Yeah, his bonus years. I thought that was such a nice way to look at it. Well, the book is Miracles We Have Seen. America's leading physicians share stories they can't forget. Dr. Harley Rothbard and Dr. Paul Scudder, thanks so much for joining us. And really, the stories in here are just fabulous. And I'm so glad that you put this project together.
Thank you, Mindy. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.